What do you see on the horizon? Uncertainty or opportunity? Whatever you see, at PGIM, we can help you rise to the challenges of today, providing outlooks on the market with deep global and local expertise. With over 1,400 investment professionals in pursuit of long-term returns, our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Joe Weisenthal.
And I'm Tracy Alloway.
Tracy, you know what I was thinking? Like, there's so much attention to Elon Musk and all of his controversies and the things that he does in his personal life and Twitter and potentially buying Twitter and the tweets and everything. I think sometimes people forget, like, what an extraordinary success or what an extraordinary company just like Tesla has been over the last decade.
Oh boy, where to start? Well, first of all, a cynic might say that Elon Musk courts that kind of controversy quite actively, and that maybe if he wanted the focus to be on what Tesla was doing, he could go about it a different way. But anyway, yes, Tesla, I mean, just looking at the share price, it's down obviously from its peak, but over its history, it's, you know, a very successful company from a purely financials basis, or just looking at the share price.
Yeah. And, you know, like when I think about the last decade, obviously it was about the rise of software. Software is eating the world. Cryptocurrency, all these sort of things that just like exist in code. And here is a company that became the biggest car company in the world, at least by market cap, by actually manufacturing something that is actually built. And so this was a decade in which people weren't really into manufacturing and really weren't into capital intensive businesses. And yet during that decade, this one company sort of like just did extraordinarily well at a time when that wasn't really that cool.
Right. Okay. So this is possibly one of the few things that you cannot fault Elon Musk for, but he certainly likes to make things, right? And you can debate whether or not those things are realistic, but everything from electric cars to flamethrowers to, you know, tunnels underground.
Satellite launching equipment that lands.
Starlink. Yeah. He makes things at a time when the emphasis wasn't really on making things. It was on software, as you mentioned, and sort of the ephemeral stuff, big ideas and changing the world through technology, but not necessarily tangible technology.
Right. And of course, one of our themes, and it's something that we hit on with a lot of our commodities episodes and, you know, some of our conversations with Jeff Currie and all kinds of things that we've been doing over the last year, has been about this sort of the revenge of the real, the tangible economy, actually putting stuff together. It's really hard, but it's sort of, it feels like the sort of like physical engineering is going to be one of the huge themes of this next decade.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, I think maybe we're so used to thinking about technology as like a search engine or a software company. But it feels like that might be starting to change. And nowadays, when people think about technology, when they think about technological prowess, it feels like a lot of people think about things like semiconductors and chips and the actual physical components that drive that kind of technological innovation.
Yeah. And so when you think about like manufacturing tech, right? Like, okay, we're talking about who's manufacturing. You might think of Taiwan Semiconductor, of which, of course, we've done episodes, Intel. And then another name that has to come up in all of that has to be Foxconn, which everybody knows is basically the company that makes the iPhones, the company that assembles the iPhones.
Yeah, that's right. So I think, again, this is sort of one of the big themes that has come out of the past couple of years in the global pandemic, but also even the trade war before that. But we all are intensely aware now of how these tech supply chains actually work and where things are made and who is putting them together.
Yeah. And so did you know, well, I didn't know this up until recently, but did you know that Foxconn itself wants to get into the electric vehicle game?
I didn't know that either. I know that the head of Foxconn, Terry Guo, I know he's an ambitious guy. He has plans, but I didn't know about this specific space. So yeah, I'm interested in learning more about it.
Yeah, and I think you're sort of like, it's hard to understand the world over the last several decades without understanding the trajectory of Foxconn. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they want to be a player in EVs is really interesting. So I think we should talk about it.
Let's do it.
All right, I'm very excited because in studio with us, this is a real treat, in studio with us, we have Tim Culpin. He is a Bloomberg opinion columnist, normally based in Taipei, but he is here in studio with us, and he is going to talk. He knows all about Foxconn. I think we had him on last year to mm-hmm. talk about Taiwan Semi, so he knows about the world of manufacturing, the real economy that most people forgot over the last decade.
Plus,
he knows a lot about it.
Plus, he brought us pineapple cakes, so you know he automatically gets an episode.
Thanks for the pineapple cakes, Tim.
No worries. Apparently, listeners, if you do want to get onto the Odd Lots podcast, you just have to bribe Tracy and Joe with goodies. And
we just want
cakes
pastry.
Tracy
pastries.
Really likes sweet. Okay, I don't know Tracy's opinion on Elon Musk, but I know that Tracy likes sweet. So yes, if you want to get on Odd Lots, send Tracy a pineapple cake or some other pastry, and you will probably get invited.
It's really that easy.
Tim, great to have you. Great to have you here. What is Foxconn?
Oh, I didn't expect you to give me such an open-ended question. All right, so our producer Carmen's going to have to cut this after about 3 hours when you give me that question. What's interesting, I'm going to go back in time in history,
okay.
if you'll indulge me.
Please.
I think everyone first started to learn about Foxconn in 2010. That was when the unfortunate suicides happened and the company became famous because of it. And there's about a dozen suicides that year. And even Foxconn chairman and founder Terry Guo, at first there was a couple of suicides, and he admitted to us when we interviewed him at that time, didn't think it was a big deal. And to put it in context, at the time they had about 1 million employees. So if you go to any town in America or in China or anywhere in the world, you know, with 1 million employees, it's unfortunate that you're going to have, you know, a couple of suicides. It's just an unfortunate reality. So he didn't think it was a big deal, but after about the fifth, he was like, oh, we've really got an issue here. Mm. And of course, it got a lot of global attention from everybody, including us at Bloomberg and Bloomberg Businessweek. But that's really what put Foxconn on the radar. But they've been going since the mid-70s. Terry Guo, who was born in Taiwan, was one of the first people to embrace Shenzhen in China, you know, across the other side of the Taiwan Strait. He went there at the time when China had decided that Shenzhen would be this special economic zone. And China was just starting to open up to the world. And Terry Guo was very quick to embrace it. He saw a real potential. Obviously, cheap labor was a real draw card, but he saw a potential for a very large labor pool and also the fact that there could be a supply chain building there. So he was one of the first people to say, you know what, this is the place to be. And so he went and set up shop there. And one of the kind of the craziest ways or simplest ways that he could get he could hire employees, because there was a lot of competition for labor at the time, was that he decided to just treat them a little bit better than other employers in China. Now, people look at the Foxconn scandal and say, oh, you know, they're a sweatshop and they're terrible on staff and, you know, treat labor badly. Actually, in context, And I sound like a bit of a Foxconn apologist here. But in context, they did actually treat their employees in the early days and right through their history actually a lot better than a lot of employees employers do in China. And so one of the first things Terry Guo did was he said, okay, I want all of my my workers to eat well. So every single one of them would get an egg a day so they could get a bit of protein. That was kind of a bit of a way out idea at the time.
This was, just to be clear, this was in the 80s?
70s and 80s.
70s and 80s, okay.
Yeah. And so Terry Guo is not an electronics guy. Most people in the tech industry have a tech background. They have an electronics background, maybe electronic engineering. Terry Guo studied at a maritime college in northern Taiwan. So he really studied shipping and logistics. And then he moved into plastics. So he's kind of opening business was plastic injection molding. And if you think of Taiwan in the 70s and 80s, it was known as, you know, made in Taiwan, cheap plastic toys, Barbie dolls and everything else was made in Taiwan. So that was his business. He was a plastics guy. One of his first things was to make the little plastic tuner knobs on RCA TVs. And over time, he went more and more into plastics. And when the electronics boom happened from, you know, the 80s, he started getting into the business of making the connectors that would connect, say, your printer to your PC or your Atari to the television. And if you remember, you know, those of us of age can remember they were flat cables with, you know, 24, 36 pins. They were kind of difficult to make. And so if you could work out ways to make these connectors, you could get pretty fat margins. And so the name Foxconn, the con in Foxconn is connector. That's where the name comes from.
I did not know that.
And as an interesting aside, his brother runs a company called FoxLink, which does the cable part, the boring cable that goes between the two connectors. Now, of course, that's not as exciting anymore because pretty much everybody's on USB and FireWire and everything else. But back then, there was like 60 different types of connectors. And since then, they have basically been a component company. And so we think of them as being a company that hires a million workers, you know, at peak time to assemble iPhones. But if you look at the numbers, you know, back in the mid-90s when the PC boom was happening and people like Michael Dell and others decided that they want to be in the PC business, Foxconn got into the business of just creating the components. They weren't really assembling that much. They were doing the components that went inside. And if you ever open up a desktop PC, you'll see the motherboard inside and there's just all sorts of componentry welded to the motherboard. That's the business that Foxconn was in. And that's, to this day, kind of the business they're in right now. We just don't really think of it because it's not as sexy. But I tell you one thing, guys, the margins are really, really, really good. So in 1996, their gross margins were over 30%. And if anyone really kind of dives into you know, the margins business, I know you've had Stacey Razgon on co-cover semis.
Yeah.
30% is a really nice gross margin. And at the time, Apple, which was kind of at its worst period in 96, was doing 10% gross margins. So they did very, very well. Now, in context, margins at Foxconn dropped off over the next decade as they went more and more into assembly, which is not a margin business.
I was going to ask, can you talk a little bit more about the difference between making components versus assembly and why what Foxconn is doing, you know, was somewhat unusual at the time, is my understanding.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question. So components, I mean, the most high-level components are chips, right? Taiwan Semiconductor, we talked about before, and that's the sexy part of the industry. But going down the supply chain, you get these chips and you put them onto a module, you weld them together. There's so many chips inside a computer or inside an iPhone that are kind of boring, you know, capacitors and things that control the voltage with inside a computing system. Now, the thing about these is they sell for a dollar or two. They don't sell for a lot of money, but they're huge, huge volume. And because they're very, very, very specialized, it's not easy to swap out one component from another. So if you're a company like Foxconn, as they were in the 90s, and you work out exactly how to do exactly the right component with all the right specs, and your clients, all the PC makers, electronics makers go, that's just the component I need. It's only a dollar. But I need it and it's got to work. It can't, you know, it can't mess up. They will put in orders for millions of them. They buy them by the bucket. And if you're someone like Foxconn who can do that really well and set up a production system that makes them really well, you've got fat margins. So it's very high volume, but low price. Like the price point is very low, but with fat margins, you can be a very, very profitable company. And you've almost got the market to yourself in some of these components because the barriers to entry are quite high. And that's really the bread and butter of Foxconn even to this day. They make a lot of money from an iPhone from the components that go inside an iPhone rather than actually assembling an iPhone.
How did Apple find Foxconn?
Well, when Steve Jobs came back, as we all know, the company was in trouble. Apple was actually making their own computers, like physically making them in California. But over a period of time, many companies, Michael Dell and Hewlett-Packard, Compaq and others, were starting to outsource to Asia. And at some point during that period of time, Tim Cook, who was operating officer at the time, he'd not yet become CEO, would have discovered Foxconn and realized that, you know, these guys make the components. We should probably get to know them. And they really jumped into bed deeply when the iPod came out in the early 2000s. And that was one of the first high volume electronics product after maybe, the Sony Walkman.
Right.
And no one else really had the kind of scale in Shenzhen to do it. So it was really started with the iPod era. And it was only the iPhone that came, almost a decade later or less than a decade later. And when, Tim Cook needed someone to assemble this new gadget that nobody had ever heard of but heard rumors of, Foxconn was the place to go.
Wait, on this question of, assembly, so, I'm sort of thinking about, actually our Taiwan Semi conversation. And, Taiwan Semi, over time, builds up an expertise to be able to manufacture chips at scale while making very few errors, and they just become really good at it. What is, is it similar with Foxconn, where just over time they just sort of build up this internal muscle where, you can come up with a new design. Here's the design of an iPhone, here's the design of an iPod. And because they've just, built up this sort of, internal tacit knowledge of how to assemble things, it's just no one else can really do something like that at scale and have it be consistently good.
Precisely. That's really, really it. It's not that difficult to make one pizza.
Yeah.
You try and make 50 pizzas an hour or, 1,000 pizzas an hour. That's difficult because quality, yield, right? The amount of products that you put through the production line that are usable at the end, that is very, very difficult. Scale is really what it's all about. In pretty much any industry, even in cars, Tesla's, struggles over the years have been about scaling.
Yeah.
And so, you're right. They had built up this this knowledge base from making components so that when it came to things that were a bit more labor intensive, and they had used a lot of labor even for their components, this was the company that you would turn to. And, what is it? A dozen years after the first iPhone came out, 70% of iPhones are still made by Foxconn, right? Apple can't replace them. They're addicted to Foxconn.
I was going to ask, what is the relationship like between those two entities? Because on the one hand, Foxconn providing a valuable service for Apple, clearly, but it feels like Apple is basically reliant on one supplier here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a possibly an unhealthy, I've argued for a long time, it's a very unhealthy codependence. There is really, if you look at the tech industry globally or the world in general, if Apple was to disappear overnight, we wouldn't get our iPhones and, maybe that wouldn't be a very nice thing, or if Facebook disappeared, that would be terrible, or some people might argue the opposite. But if Foxconn or TSMC were to disappear from the face of the earth overnight, we'd be in a lot of trouble because nobody can do what these two companies can do. And they even, if they tried, and so many companies have been trying to replace Foxconn, Apple doesn't want to be addicted to Foxconn, right? It's just not healthy. It's not about them being a good or a bad company. It's just not healthy to have one supplier. So over the years, Apple has diversified away, ironically, to mostly Taiwanese companies like Wistron and Pegatron and some Chinese companies too. And of course, they've diversified away from China to an extent in India and Brazil and other places. But really, they can't help it. And Foxconn is also unhealthily addicted to Apple. 50% of their revenue comes from Apple. And it's been that way for more than a decade. They brought in about $215 billion of revenue last year, Foxconn, and half of that came from Apple. So they can't do without Apple unless they get into the EV business.
Bonds are back. And so is All the Credit, PGIM Fixed Income's monthly podcast series. From the latest trends to long-term perspectives, you'll get timely fixed income insights from leading economists, research analysts, and investment professionals. Whether you're new to bonds or a seasoned investor, tune in to All the Credit wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is intended solely for professional investor use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
The hottest gadget, or one of the hottest gadgets in the world right now, is the electric vehicle, and Tesla is the leader, but we know that every car company wants to get into EVs, and they're spending a lot of money and actually rolling out cars, and some of them seem to be decent. Before we get into Foxconn's ambitions in the space, how is manufacturing a car historically different than manufacturing electronics? I mean, my guess is like GM and Ford and all, they have their own plants. They're in the United States. They don't just like make a design and send it to some other company to build. They actually build it themselves. But how would you compare and contrast the sort of like existing legacy approach to building a car versus the existing approach to building a phone?
Well, at the end of the day, I think it's a fair point. At the end of the day, I mean, car companies don't want to admit it, but all cars are kind of similar, right? now, where there is a difference is in engines, right? So companies like Toyota and Ford and the Europeans as well have worked a lot on engine design, and car buffs will say, well, this engine, this, you know, V6 or this straight four or whatever is a better engine, and a new car comes out with a new engine and people love it or hate it. But the other part, the IP, is in how you make it. And Toyota, I guess, is most famous for their production system, the just-in-time and all of that. And again, it comes back to the issue of scale and quality and yields and so forth. So the very process of producing a car is, in some ways, that secret sauce. And so if Toyota, for example, or Ford was to work out exactly the right way to make a car over, say, a 10-year production run, it's kind of a thing that they wouldn't necessarily want to hand out to somebody else. But the other thing is, with safety standards, you have to be very meticulous. And the way you produce a car is so connected to things like safety standards. And the final thing is, the product cycle of a car is much, much, much longer. We're talking like a decade, whereas, you know, the product cycle of a phone, iPhone, Apple has the longest product cycle, which is about a year. But, you know, Samsung and Xiaomi or whatever, they come out with a new product like every 3 to 6 months or even less. So it's a very quick turnaround. And so they kind of need the external help to help put these devices together. I think that's really the big difference.
So walk us through Foxconn's thinking here and what they see exactly as their competitive advantage. Because on the one hand, yes, EV is very hot right now. Everyone is probably going to end up having one in the future. But on the other hand, especially in places like Asia, the market is incredibly crowded. It feels like a new EV manufacturer springs up, you know, every week or every month, and then probably has problems soon after. But what exactly is the opportunity here, and what does Foxconn think it can do better than other EV manufacturers?
Well, what's interesting, I think, is that you think of Foxconn as being the iPhone assembler, and you think, well, if they're going to do EVs, they're going to be all about the, you know, EV assembling with big factories like you'd see in Detroit. That's actually not quite their thinking. They're more thinking in the 1990s model, which is in the 1990s when desktop PCs were, you know, the biggest thing out there, it was very modular. You open up a PC and it's very, very modular, and you've got standard reference designs for what it would look like. And, you know, at that time you have, you know, AMD and Intel were doing the CPUs, and Foxconn could make a lot of those component parts and get good margins on it. They see EVs more similar to PCs than iPhones. And so they have reference designs, right? If you want to go out, like literally, if you had the money, you could call up Foxconn tomorrow and say, hey, we want to make an EV. We don't have a clue. We've just got money. And Foxconn are like, all right, we've got a reference design. Literally, it is a design. It's a chassis with four wheels, and they can basically walk you through the process. And for the right amount of money, you could have an EV, you know, in 6 months. And that's why you've got companies like Lordstown and Rivian and all these other startups are actually turning to Foxconn and saying, oh, yeah, we want to get into the EV business. Maybe we should, you know, get into bed with each other.
Well, so when I think about like PCs in the 90s, and there were just so many of these brands, and they basically just all sold the exact same boxes, and it didn't turn out to be. So there was Compaq and HP and... Or before that, I guess there was like...
Wang.
Yeah, there were tons. Gateway was another one. And then, of course, Dell more or less won that space. But it was like not a great victory because the actual like boxes, you know, they won, but it wasn't like the most amazing victory. Like, do the car companies... Like, okay, if Foxconn's vision that EVs will sort of be this modular thing and there's a few standard parts they could all plug and play, like... Do car companies want that future?
No, of course, car companies don't want that future any more than PC companies want to have PCs to be modular, because there's no competitive advantage. And that's why Apple went, you know, in another direction.
Remember Zeos?
There was
the PCs. That's what we had. We had a PC in like in my family. I think it was from a company called Zeos.
I remember Tandy. I think we had Tandy
Radio
as well.
Shack on
Tandy.
Yeah. Sorry, keep going.
Anyway. So no, yeah, PC company. No company wants to be standardized, right? They want to have everything to themselves. In fact, you know, if you look inside an iPhone, you know, one of the funny things about an iPhone is, of course, they have their own chips, and a lot of their own things are very, very specific to Apple. But in fact, there's quite a few components that go in an iPhone that are no different to a component that go into something else. But Apple is very insistent with their suppliers that they have their own stock coding unit, and it's labeled differently, but it's basically the same part. It's just kind of the Apple version of that part. So I think absolutely. I don't think, you know, Elon Musk at Tesla or Toyota or Ford or any company that's going into the EV era wants to have it standardized. But then again, they've got to make decisions. Where is our value add? Where is our competitive advantage? Is it to have, you know, all our unique components? And in the car era, having your own unique engine, you know, was a standout, right? And that was a unique selling point. I think so far in the EV era, I don't think anyone's going up to an EV and going, well, this is, you know, the electronic version of, you know, a V8, right? They, of course, they want range, they want power, they want, what is it, ridiculous mode and stuff like that. But if that can all be done in a standardized modular way, then that would free up the EV makers to focus on, you know, the front end, which is the design, make it look cool, feature set. And then the back end, which is sales and marketing. And essentially, that's what the PC industry is now. PC makers basically don't make anything. In fact, Apple doesn't really manufacture anything.
Right.
They do the front end, which is the design. They outsource all of the middle, which is, you know, putting it all together. And then the back end, they worry about, you know, sales and marketing. And that's probably going to be the future of EVs, certainly the way Foxconn thinks it'll be. And so there was all these PC makers in the 90s, and most of them have disappeared. Well, Foxconn's still around, and they just supplied to all of them, right? That's the way they survive. Foxconn doesn't do their own branding. They just supply to the brands. And the new vision of Foxconn, and they've got a new chairman now, a guy called Liu Yangwei, who's an electronic engineer by training. He sees that future as being Foxconn is not going back to the mid-2000s, but Foxconn going back to the mid-90s. Huh. And guess what? That's when the margins were really, really good.
That's convenient. But it feels like, to some extent, the EV manufacturers might not have a choice here, right? Because chips have been an issue. And if one of the largest suppliers of chips says, we want to go in this direction, we're going to standardize, do modular component building, that sort of thing, it feels like they might just have to go along with it, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good way to put it, Tracy. If the EV industry, it is very, very electronic, right? You know, every wheel has multiple chips just controlling it, right? Mm. Cars, there is more chips in your garage than there is in your lounge room, right? There is so many chips inside cars, which is why with the chip shortage of the last couple of years, cars couldn't roll off the production line, right? But we still managed to get our iPhones. And so the EV era is definitely more and more electronic. And that's why, in so many ways, an EV is more like a PC on wheels than a Toyota or Ford with an electronic engine. Really, that's the way you need to think about it. Certainly, that's the way a lot of companies think about it, and that's the way Foxconn thinks about it. And that's why, yeah, componentry, semiconductors, non-semiconductor components, there'll be standardization. In theory, that's where the industry is moving, and that's what Foxconn wants to do. They right. have a platform called MIH. They want to bring all of the companies together. They want to bring in the chip makers, not just the car makers, the chip makers, the electronic makers. They want to bring them all together and set the standards and say, we've got these standards. You can buy some of the components from us and some from somewhere else, not a problem. You can buy all the components from us, whatever you like, but Foxconn wants to be a part of it so that as today, apart from iPhone, pretty much every device you've got, whether it's a Dell PC or a Cisco router or some webcam, there's probably some Foxconn in there somewhere. That's what Foxconn wants to be for EVs.
So I'm guessing this is Elon, they're not part of Elon's vision. Like, how does the Foxconn vision of how the EV industry evolve contrast with Elon's vision of how the EV industry will evolve?
Well, interestingly enough, Foxconn does supply to Tesla, but it's just componentry, not the final car. Now, Elon said famously a few years ago, you know, EVs are tough. This is not the kind of thing you can outsource to Foxconn. I actually disagree. Foxconn obviously disagrees. I think it is the kind of thing you can outsource to Foxconn. It's exactly the kind of thing you can outsource to Foxconn. Now, of course, Tesla makes their own cars. They're building multiple factories around the world, and they believe that building cars is part of, you know, the Tesla DNA and their competitive advantage. But if you're Foxconn or any of these other startups, then you probably think, maybe not. And certainly to build your own car factory is very, very expensive, and there's no guarantee of payoff. Now, what's interesting is, how about the existing legacy car makers like the Europeans and the Japanese, the Koreans and the Americans? Do they still want to make their own cars, or will they at some point say, you know what, we're going to outsource a couple of models of our cars to somebody else, like a Foxconn? So one of Foxconn's partners is Stellantis, which is the merged group of PSA and Renault and all, you know, the European car makers. They are actually doing deals with Foxconn. So we may see, you know, a European car come off a Foxconn production line in future, or certainly some of the components in these European cars may be made by Foxconn. So I think the interesting question is not the startups who kind of need to have a Foxconn. It's the legacy makers. Are they willing to embrace the Foxconn model? And frankly, I don't know the answer to that.
This might be an obvious point, but part of the thing...
Bonds are back. And so is All the Credit, PGIM Fixed Income's monthly podcast series. From the latest trends to long-term perspectives, you'll get timely fixed income insights from leading economists, research analysts, and investment professionals. Whether you're new to bonds or a seasoned investor, tune in to All the Credit wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is intended solely for professional investor use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
That is sort of surprising me here, or I guess I should say the irony here is that it seems like we've had these discussions over the past few years about supply chain resiliency.
Yeah.
We've had discussions about the semiconductor shortage. And it feels like the response to all of that might be to concentrate semiconductor production and assembly even more in a single entity, because they're sort of demanding market power or the ability to assemble cars in order to control the components that are going into them. Is that the direction that we're heading? Like, rather than see multiple competitors spring up in the space, people start to retool their supply chain so that they don't rely on a single company. It feels like we're going in the other direction.
Well, if you look at TSMC, I mean, they have like 95% of the leading edge, you know, capacity. But interestingly enough, that is not the type of chips that have been in shortage. It's the old stuff, the technology that's, you know, 10 or 15 years old, that's been in shortage. And one of the reasons why it's in shortage is because people have been moving forward. You know, the chip industry, as you guys have spoken about quite a few times, it's a very fast-moving industry. You know, Moore's Law means that every couple of years you upgrade your technology. But a lot of the chip designers didn't really want to move up the supply chain or, you know, the technology stack because they didn't need to. So that's where we are with the shortage. But going forward, I think there's going to be a lot of government involvement. Obviously, the US government, Congress is kind of duking it out over the CHIPS package, the CHIPS right. Act. The Europeans are doing a similar one. They would like to have control of the chip industry in more companies, or at least in companies from their domicile. So obviously, Intel wants to get in on the game. There's European makers. But at the same time, everybody wants a TSMC factory in their backyard, right? TSMC is the most popular company in the world for economy ministers because they all want to get TSMC over there. But if you look at Foxconn, what's interesting with cars is, it's just not as easy to, you can't, you know, pack up 60 cars in a box and put them on a right. on a FedEx flight, right? So this is a really smart way for Foxconn to diversify geographically. Now, no matter what you think of the tech Cold War, is it overblown? Is it unfair? Will it blow over? It's really not smart to have all of your supply chain in one area. In the same way, it's not smart to have so much of your supply from one or two companies like Foxconn and TSMC. It just doesn't make sense to have all of your supply chain in, you know, the Shenzhen area or Zhengzhou area of China. Foxconn knows that. But by moving into EVs as they are, they've got a plant in Ohio. They've got this factory in Wisconsin, which may or may not make EVs. They're looking at India and Indonesia, and we'll probably see something in, I would guess, Mexico, Eastern Europe. Great way to diversify your geographical locations, because it makes sense to have your car production closer to where your market will be.
Yeah, I want to expand on this further, because if you think about, as you mentioned, the era where they're selling, you know, millions of dollar capacitors by the bucket, and it's very easy to manufacture in Shenzhen and then put on a boat. Clearly, the geography of automobile manufacturing is already much more localized, and you don't see GM or Ford manufacture a car in China for the purpose of shipping it to the United States. And they set up factories in Georgia or Tennessee and still in Michigan or elsewhere. And so it does seem as though this would, the economic, the weight of car components, just the sheer size, the cost of them, it seems like it has to be much more geographically dispersed.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's just a really nice segue for Foxconn to have less of their production capacity in one geography. And they don't have to be announcing that they're picking up and leaving China. They just, you know, all of their every extra dollar of CapEx that they put into something over the next few years just happens to not be in China for solid economic reasons. And so I would predict that, say, 10 years from now, a lot less of its balance sheet in terms of factory and equipment will be in China. And it won't be a case of them upping and leaving China. It will just be a natural kind of evolution away from China. And I think that's exactly what Foxconn and its clients would want.
So I know you talked about the sort of the historical experience that lends itself to Foxconn moving into this area of EV assembly, sort of doing a similar thing to what they did with PCs in the 90s. But are there any stumbling blocks here? Like, what is the biggest challenge in moving to that production model?
I think one of them, that's a really good point. And that's the kind of thing that probably even catch out Foxconn. And I think one of them is regulation. Cars are very, very regulated, right? In terms of safety standards, well, you know, there was emission standards, but obviously that doesn't quite apply to EVs, but there's various types of standards. And if you're going through the process of setting up, you know, a reference design, and you're slotting in different components, even, you know, like what kind of seats, and, you know, the seat's going to buckle up electronically or braking, and all of the other things. Like, for example, Tesla had a minor problem recently where the chip inside that center console was kind of overheating, and that made it difficult, like, because everything is controlled by the center console of a Tesla. You basically kind of had to reboot the car to make it work. Now, there was no safety issue involved in that, but it highlights the issue that as we get more and more electronic, the electronics are very important. I think we will see safety regulators in the US, in Europe, and elsewhere want to be much more cognizant of that. And so this could be a real problem for Foxconn, or maybe it's an opportunity for Foxconn, because if they can get into the process of getting the parts or components or half-assembled cars, go through that safety standard check and licensing themselves with the Europeans or the Americans or Japanese or whomever, and then they could possibly sell that to the client and say, hey, this part of the process, the chassis with the seats and the engine, have already gone through compliance. It's been ticked and signed off. You should buy from us. Or alternatively, the car makers may find that's not working for them because, you know, Foxconn doesn't do that or doesn't provide that. And that's the car maker's specialty. They may decide, actually, it's still better for us to do this ourselves because the design process is very much focused around, you know, safety, building in the safety at the start of that process. Now, comparing that to the PC era of the 90s, as you point out, Tracy, there really wasn't that issue. You know, if Michael Dell wants to cobble together a computer, you know, in his garage in Round Rock, Texas, he doesn't have to go off to some regulator to get signed off for safety. Right. And so anyone could put together a PC from kind of standard parts. So I think regulation and safety standards will probably be the biggest challenge that Foxconn or anyone who wants to get into the EV space will face.
So I just have two more questions. One is sort of quick. How big is Foxconn, I guess, I don't know, from a revenue standpoint these days, and how big does it see, or how big could this market get, or how important could it get for Foxconn?
So their revenue last year was around $215 billion. By comparison, you know, Apple's was, you know, 360-370, so about two-thirds of what Apple's was. Interestingly, by comparison, TSMC's revenue last year was only $56 billion, so it was like less than, around a quarter of what Foxconn's was. But of course, TSMC's margins are exponentially higher. So that's putting into perspective of where we are today. But going forward, Foxconn just recently put out some of their own targets, and they think that they're targeting to ship 500,000 to 750,000 EVs annually by 2025. And they see that translating to $34 billion of revenue by 2025. So, you know, back of the envelope numbers, that means they would expect revenue of around $45,000 per car.
So that's already a pretty significant chunk of the of their business
then.
That's
huge. That's huge, right? And even if they got really bad margins out of that, you know, 1% margins on $45,000 is a lot better than 10% margins on a $1,000 iPhone.
Yeah, that's it. So then I guess the other question I have too is like the key component in a electric car is obviously the battery, and there's a lot of effort. A, is that an area that they could ever get into, try to get into the battery itself, which is a really, seems like a very tough business. But B, battery aside, what are the components that they have like the best shot at building?
They are actually in the battery business. They're not a huge player. They've developed their own battery technology in Taiwan. I didn't even know this until I just stumbled upon it at a conference one day, and there's this booth with Foxconn batteries. I'm like, you guys do batteries? Like, yeah, we developed our own technology. It's all chemistry, right, at the end of the day. I don't know if they'll be a big player in it, but they certainly have that option. And I guess it comes down to who can get the lithium supply.
Yeah.
But in terms of the rest of it, I think, interestingly enough, you go back to their roots, connectors, like inside a car, there is a lot of connections. There's a lot of wiring. I think if, we look inside a Boeing or an Airbus jet, there's like miles and miles and miles of cables and connectors and stuff. A car is kind of similar. So the connectors is definitely a great business for them to be in. And then a lot of the components, like a windscreen wiper, the lights, all of those things just have a little motherboard with some components soldered onto it. And so they don't necessarily need to get the big ticket items. They could just tick off a lot of the kind of the smaller items and just get a lot of them inside a car and just be that company that does these 10 things really, really well that no one else can do. And enjoy the margins from there.
Tim Kolpin, real treat to have you here in the studio. And this is totally new for me. I had no idea that Foxconn was aiming for this space, but it seems like an important part of the story. So appreciate you coming back on Oddlot.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. And thank you for the pineapple cakes. Yeah, love talking about semiconductors while eating.
The real reason we had Tim on. But no, that was great. Thank you so much. Tracy, I really thought that was interesting. I didn't realize the history of Foxconn. I mean, I just basically sort of only, as Tim said, more or less ever heard of the company around 2010 when the sort of, when the sort of infamy of their iPhone production was in the news. But it's interesting that the sort of like real margin heyday was in the 90s. I had no idea that like those were like super boom times.
Right, because everyone thinks, oh, assembling iPhones, you probably make loads of money off of that. But actually, it's building the sort of modular components for
I didn't realize that they were like the ones building all those modules.
Yeah, the other thing that stuck out for me from that conversation was just the idea of a company like Foxconn becoming more of a force in the EV space by virtue of building those components and in some respects demanding standardization.
Yeah.
And I wish I could remember who exactly said this, but there was a school of thought that in the future, insurers were going to be these massive influencers on society and the economy because they're the ones that are ultimately pricing and sort of dealing in risk. So they were the ones setting safety standards.
Yeah.
And I think about that with relation to something like Foxconn. If they're the ones building the components and setting the standards for some of the things going into EVs, and to Tim's point, obviously they have to comply with government standards as well, but there are other things they can influence. It feels like they just become a really big force in the space.
Absolutely. It feels like the existing automakers, obviously Tesla, but Tesla aside, but it seems like the existing automakers definitely do not want to become Dell and Hewlett Packard and Compaq and Zeos and Tandy and Gateway.
Yeah.
And just be like pure boxes on a bunch of components that are all identical and no margin. But on the other hand, like, cars all kind of look the same, but of course car people would but they're like wildly different.
You're gonna get a bunch of angry emails about.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between cars, especially these days. They'll kind of look the same.
Well, I mean, it does feel like there is this massive tension between Foxconn and its potential customers in the form of EV manufacturers. And it's, you know, it's not, again, dissimilar to maybe the relationship between Apple and Foxconn, but it's going to be really interesting to see how it shakes out. And it does feel like a bit of a power struggle, potentially.
Yeah. And either way, it is going to be different than PCs or the iPhone because of this. There's all, it's almost certainly going to be the US car market is served by US manufacturing. Whether it's a Foxconn factory, whether it's a Rivian factory, whether it's a GM factory, it's going to be domestic. So it's not going to be this sort of like, oh, let's build a bunch of cheap stuff in Asia for shipping over. There'll probably be some component shipping, but it will still be something of a new model that's different than Foxconn's past.
Seems like it. All right. Shall we leave it there?
Let's leave it there.
All right. This has been another episode of the Odd Lots podcast. I'm Tracy Alloway. You can follow me on Twitter at Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Jill Wiesenthal. You can follow me on Twitter at The Stalwart. And follow our guest, Tim Culpin, on Twitter. He's at T Culpin. Follow our producer, Carmen Rodriguez, at Carmen Arman. Follow the Bloomberg head of podcast, Francesca Levy, at Francesca Today. And check out all of our podcasts at Bloomberg under the handle at Podcasts. Thanks for listening.